Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Haunted to Death by Frank Anthony Polito. Narrated by Frank Anthony Polito. To Charlene, my psychic cousin, and to Aunt Tony, who told us scary stories. Come back and haunt me anytime, you two. Halloween, 1997. Emma stood on the third floor balcony in the white wedding gown. Tears streamed from her piercing blue eyes as she listened to the melancholy tinkling of her favorite music box. The automated instrument rested atop the nightstand in the room behind her, next to the canopy-covered bed she shared with her husband. The melody gave her comfort as she struggled to come to terms with the realization she'd known for far too long. Bill Woods never loved her. She gazed out at the garden party below, her costumed guest dancing in the dark. She felt a surge of anger and betrayal, amplified by the effects of alcohol on her physical and mental state. How could he do this to her, his own wife? And if her suspicions were correct, he'd also been keeping a secret since the day they were married 3 years before. Her thoughts were interrupted by his voice calling out her name from the hallway. She spun around, clutching tightly the key to their bedroom door, and shouted across the master suite for him to leave her alone. Her other hand found its way up to the diamond necklace hanging about her neck, a birthday present from her husband earlier that evening. The lavish piece of jewelry probably cost a small fortune. He had the audacity to surprise her with it in front of all their friends, when all along he knew the gift had no meaning. It was purely a gesture of show, nothing more. Bill ordered her to open the door. His command was muffled through the heavy wood, but she could hear the fear in his voice. When she confronted him about the affair moments ago, his face went white with shock. He stammered and stuttered, struggling to find the words to explain his infidelity. His eyes darted around the room as he looked for an escape. He tried denying her accusations. His shoulders slumped and his head hung low, as he realized there was no way out. Emma decided she'd had enough. She was tired of Bill's lies more than anything. She knew in her heart that he didn't care for her, and she didn't care for him. Their marriage was one of convenience, arranged by their fathers to join their two dynasties into a single powerful union. Still, Emma couldn't bear the thought of Bill leaving her. Not for their housekeeper and the son he fathered with the older woman over 9 years ago. She couldn't let him win. She needed to find a way to take control of her own life, to break free from the deceit surrounding her world for far too long. Bill called out to her again, this time with great conviction. She twisted a lock of her honey blonde hair and took a deep breath. She thought of her precious daughter asleep in the nursery one floor below. Emma didn't want their child growing up in a home filled with dishonesty. She thought of the shame and embarrassment she'd feel, pretending everything was all right when everyone else knew otherwise. She knew staying with Bill would only perpetuate the cycle of deception, and she refused to subject her daughter to that. The shame of remaining in a loveless marriage was far too much to bear. She had to be strong for her daughter's sake. She needed to make a difficult choice that would ultimately be in their mutual best interest. Turning back to the balcony rail, she came to a decision. She gripped the cold, wrought iron, her knuckles turning white, and she leaned forward. Someone appeared in the bedroom behind Emma. Hearing the footfall, swiftly she spun around. Then she screamed out. The fall happened in slow motion, as if time had stalled to watch Emma plummet 3 floors to the flagstone patio below. The white wedding gown billowed around her as she descended, her body twisting and turning in the pale moonlight. As she hit the ground, the sound of live music was stifled by the shock and silence filling the crisp autumn air. Her startled guest rushed to her side, calling out for help, for an ambulance, for someone to do something. But it was too late. Emma Woods was dead. 25 years later. Chapter 1. No one really knew if the old house was haunted. According to local legend, the stately arts and crafts-inspired manor was cursed from day one. Built in 1913 by lumber baron William Royce Woods, the home's original owner had made a deal with a powerful Native American shaman. The shaman warned that if Woods disturbed the spirits of the land, a curse would be placed upon his family for generations to come. William, a man of science and reason, dismissed the shaman's warning as mere superstition. The lumber baron laughed off the hex, believing it to be nothing more than the tales of some old Indian. Woods proceeded clearing the 1.3-acre plot of land on the outskirts of town and constructing his grand mansion, Woods Hall, ignoring the consequences of his actions. But as the years passed, the curse seemed to only intensify. Visitors to the manor reported an overwhelming sense of unease, and many refused to spend the night when invited. All around, strange things started happening. Woods's once loyal employees deserted him, and the market crash of 1929 decimated much of the fortune amassed by his company, Woods Lumber. The unfortunate events of Black Tuesday, some believed, led to poor William's untimely demise. Or was the hex of the Native American shaman responsible for the lumber baron's downfall? Convinced of his failure and fearing he'd let down his family, the elder Woods believed he no longer had reason to live. In the early hours of a cold winter morning, the once wealthy and powerful man hung himself. He was just shy of 42. This was only the beginning of the effects felt by the shaman's inescapable curse. Fortunately for the Woods family, the lumber business bounced back after the Great Depression. Nearly 30 years passed without incident. William's wife, Fern Elizabeth Woods, née Ridge, had long ago been made aware of the wicked spell cast upon her husband. Having already reached her 70th birthday, Fern was certain that her privileged world would forever remain untarnished. However, in the fall of 58, the woman's relatively long life was cut short by a deadly virus. The pandemic caused by the H2N2 strain of influenza had already killed thousands across the globe, and soon it would find its way to the tiny historic town of Pleasant Woods, Michigan. A series of unfortunate deaths followed. First, there was William and Fern's son, William Rice II, and his wife Dorothy, who died on the same February evening after their luxury car became stranded in 4 feet of snow during the Great Blizzard of 1978. The couple, both in their middle 50s, preferred wintering in a warmer climate. That season, however, they chose a ski trip to Boyne Mountain instead of their usual Caribbean island vacation. Less than 2 decades later, Barbara Woods, the spouse of William III, lost her battle with liver cancer. She'd never drunk a drop of alcohol. Shortly thereafter, William Royce III himself perished, claimed by a massive coronary that took him kicking and screaming into the hereafter while enjoying his morning coffee. William Royce IV, a.k.a. Bill, died later that same year, along with his brand-new bride and former housekeeper, a single mother named Kathleen. Tragically, the private plane carrying the newlyweds to their Mackinac Island honeymoon went down over Lake Huron. They left behind a pair of orphans, a 2-year-old girl belonging to Bill, and Kathleen's 11-year-old son. But perhaps the most questionable passing occurred a quarter century ago. Bill's first wife, Emma Wheeler, a beauty queen turned model and the mother of Bill's orphan daughter, fell from the third-floor balcony of Woods Hall during her own 25th birthday Halloween celebration. Or did she jump? Or was she pushed? No one quite knew for sure. It was this mystery, and the alleged haunting by Emma Woods of the home she and her family once shared, that we domestic partners in crime would soon be tasked to solve. JP held open the doors as we entered the Top Dog Brewery in downtown Royal Heights. At close to 9 o'clock on Labor Day weekend, the bar was full of patrons ranging in age from Gen X through Z. My partner and I fell smack dab in the middle, both millennials in our mid-30s. Well, at 34, I considered myself early mid-30s. JP, however, turned 36 this past June 27th, so he was definitely just plain mid. Me, I had almost 3 full months till my next birthday on November 21st, making me a Scorpio to his Cancer. As per my preferred astrologer, Miss Zelda, I read her horoscopes every night before bed, as soon as they were posted. Our coupling made for one of the best in the zodiac, so long as the couple in question was willing to put in the effort to support each other. Both water signs, Cancer and Scorpio, share common traits, resulting in a good potential for a harmonious relationship. Both signs are also known for being deeply emotional, intuitive, and empathetic, which help them understand each other on a deep level. Cancer is a nurturing and protective sign, while Scorpio is passionate and intense. This combination can create a strong bond between the two signs, as Scorpio is drawn to Cancer's gentle nature and Cancer is attracted to Scorpio's intense energy. That last part, I totally felt in terms of my current stress level. Growing paranoid, I crane my neck like an anxious ostrich, or whatever bird or animal might crane their neck to get a better view of his or her surroundings. As a pocket gay, I had a hard time looking past anyone taller than my 5'7". Thankfully, at 6'2", JP could serve as my personal guide dog. You see them anywhere? JP surveyed the jam-packed room with its high tin ceilings draped with Edison bulbs and strands of twinkling white lights. Not sure. The air practically pulsated thick with the scent of hops and the sound of lively chatter and upbeat music. People gathered in every corner, soaking in the vibrant atmosphere at one of the hippest spots in Metro Detroit. All were dressed in a mix of vintage and contemporary fashion, their outfits carefully curated to create the perfect Instagram-worthy look. A visual feast for the eyes, giant murals and framed artwork adorned every inch of available space on the exposed brick walls. At long communal tables, groups of friends laughed and chatted excitedly over shared small plates and charcuterie boards. They munched on street tacos of al pastor, topped with cilantro and pineapple, bacon-wrapped hot dogs, and beer-battered fried pickles. A sense of FOMO seized me, and suddenly, I was super hungry. Once we found the other couple, I definitely needed a beer and some fried Brussels sprouts. "I sent you the link to their latest video," I reminded JP, mildly annoyed. "Midnight Musings," off their sophomore album, Hazy Days and Lazy Afternoons. Clearly, he didn't know who exactly we were looking for. "Did you watch it?" JP stared down his broad nose, a slight bump across the bridge, caused by a sucker punch he got one time leaving a college sports bar back in Pittsburgh long before we met. His nostrils flared and his jaw clenched. I knew just what he was going to say. "For Pete's sake, Pete!" Even though most everyone else called me Peter, he always dropped the R, especially whenever he got defensive. I couldn't help noticing in that tension-filled moment the hotness factor of the man standing with me. "I did watch it. But how am I supposed to remember what they look like? These Zoomers are all the same. You can't tell them apart." I heaved a heavy sigh at his indignant attitude. Still, after almost 6 years, I counted myself lucky to have found him. John Paul Broadway was by far the most beautiful man I'd ever set eyes on. Tall, dark, and sexy didn't begin to describe the star of screens, both big and small. Dressed in a pale blue polo that hugged his baseball biceps and made his bright eyes pop, he looked gorgeous as always. His pecs still had the pump from a trip to our local community wellness center earlier that afternoon, a free perk paid for by our property taxes. I felt it too. My Tigers t-shirt always clung a little tighter after a good workout. Pulling my phone from my shorts pocket, I took a quick peek at my texts. The thread we exchanged earlier that day assured me they'd be here. "Hey, we still on for tonight?" "For sure." "Okay, 9 p.m. at TD in RH? "Perfect. See you then. XO." I considered sending another message, but I didn't want to come off as being too eager or annoying. Having access to her personal number was a privilege. It would only make things weird if I overused it. No need to give her a reason to block me on day one. But what if they were delayed? Or, God forbid, something went wrong and they couldn't make it after all? Though in that case, wouldn't she have texted again to tell me? Or took the time to put the phone to her ear and actually call? The one thing I couldn't stand was a lack of communication. If I said I was going to be somewhere, I showed up. And if I was ever running behind schedule, I made it a point to let the person I was supposed to be meeting know I'd be there ASAP. Still, this was a pair of 25-year-old semi-famous musicians we were dealing with. Compared to me and JP, they were children. Maybe their mothers never instilled in them a sense of responsibility. I hated to be all, heck yeah, but come on, kids, get it together. Before I could work myself into a frenzy, ruminating over the rules of proper etiquette and decorum, JP piped up. Is that them? Where? The cute couple with the entourage. Sure enough, it was the members of my new favorite band, Lo-Fi. The moniker not only indicated the type of music they made, but it also combined the duo's names, Fiona Forrest and Finn Lowenstein. Near a high-top table in the corner, a diverse crowd of a dozen adoring followers congregated, all clamoring to take a selfie or score a signature on a crumpled napkin. My pulse quickened in expectation of the event about to befall us. Were my palms sweating? Talk about a total cliche. But I'd been looking forward to this appointment for months, ever since Ursula picked Woods Hole as the next project we'd tackle on Domestic Partners. The fact that the house, an historic manor located at 13 Woods Way in our hometown of Pleasant Woods, was rumored to be haunted, only sealed the deal when it came down to her final decision. Chapter 2 JP acted all casual. Shall we? He took my hand and led us across the concrete floor, gently clearing a path through the sea of bodies. The sound of chatter and clinking glasses filled the brew pub, but I could hardly hear a thing over my own beating heart. Excuse us. I waited a second before interrupting. Yes? Fiona Forrest looked at me with piercing blue eyes. Her honey blonde hair fell in waves across a pair of delicate shoulders. She wore a vintage crop top, the color of sunshine, paired with high-waisted jeans, cut off at the knees and folded a la 1991, and well-worn leather sandals. She blinked in recognition. Hey, PJ Penwell! The J stood for James after my father. I breathed in the scent of patchouli as Fiona pulled me close. She was shorter, I'd guesstimated around 5'3", so she rose up on her tiptoes to embrace me. We exchanged a round of pleasant introductions, then headed to a semi-private booth off the back bar. Before we departed, Fiona took the time to thank her followers for stopping by to say hello. Her fiancé, on the contrary, couldn't be bothered. He didn't even say goodbye. Finn Lowenstein was a tall guy with a lean and lanky build and perpetual scruff. Not quite JP's height, he stood about 6'1", maybe. His dark hair hung into his even darker eyes. His style was a mix of edgy and everyman. He sported a plaid flannel button-down atop corduroy jeans, his feet clad in Carhartt brown work boots. A trail of tattooed musical notes floated up the inside of his right forearm. On his left, a Star of David signaled his Jewish heritage, as did the yarmulke covering the back of his head. When we first arranged our get-together, we had to make sure to wait till sundown on account of Shabbos. Finally, I'm meeting my favorite author, Fiona gushed once we were seated. My neck growing hot, I blushed with embarrassment. Sure, I enjoyed hearing the praise. What author didn't want to be labeled as someone's most beloved? But while I enjoyed my own writing style, I found it hard to imagine anyone else would feel the same way. I've read all your novels more times than I can count. Death of a Drama Club Diva is the best. You just made Pete's day, said JP, patting me on the shoulder. Fiona touched my hand across the tabletop. A hand-inked hummingbird flew about in the soft crook between her thumb and first finger. Please, I'm only telling the truth. Well, that's very kind of you, I humbly told Fiona, regarding her devotion to my literary endeavors. Over the finest in Michigan craft beers, we toasted to the success of Domestic Partners' third season. Fiona took a group selfie and posted it to Lo-Fi's official socials for all the world to see. Hashtag Lo-Fi meets domestic partners, hashtag business, hashtag top dog. She tucked away her mobile device. I love your doggies. I follow the Daily Clyde and Jack. The reel you posted of them chasing each other around the tree in your backyard. So cute. They're not twins, are they? Not biologically. They just look a lot alike, JP said. We say they're brothers from another mother. Clyde's a beagle pit bull mix, and Jack's a Parson Russell Terrier. We adopted both of our boys from a dog rescue called Home Forever. Clyde I found on the Adopt-A-Pet app early last summer. In the posted photo, a tiny white doggy with brown brindle markings on the right side of his face and a half-moon-shaped patch over his left almond-shaped eye peered sadly at the camera, his head tilted to one side ever so slightly. He had the stubbiest little legs and the tiniest pink toenails. At first sight, JP and I both fell madly in puppy love with Mr. Clyde Barker as we christened him on his official adoption papers. Clydie Boy was the sweetest pup. 32 pounds of pure muscle. Sure, he had his moments, like when another dog passed by our house, walking with its owner up the alley right off our driveway. Clyde would leap onto the window seat cushion and pound the pillow with his big front paws, barking ferociously. We couldn't fault him for protecting his domain, could we? Lord Jack Strohine, as per the name on his pedigree, joined the Broadway Penwell family this past spring. We called him Jack, or sometimes Jackson. Fortune smiled on us while having Sunday dinner with my parents, Jim and Patsy, at their home in nearby Madison Park. Over cake and coffee, Mom shared the story of how the poor little dog's dog daddy up and died, leaving him an orphan. The resemblance to our Clydie was uncanny. Same brown and white color, about the same size. He even had the same half-moon patch over his left eye. That night, I reached out to Home Forever, informing them of our desire to bring Jack into our family. And then we did. Jackson, a.k.a. Mr. Fuzzyface, was a total charmer. While he weighed a good 10 pounds less than his big brother, his long limbs gave him a slight advantage in the height department. He did this thing where he'd lie down flat on his belly, with his two front legs crossed one over the other in a jaunty fashion. We called it fancy paws. "Thought pits are illegal around here," Finn scoffed. I hated how pit bulls got such a bad rap. Not in PW, and he's only part pit. Pleasant Woods was an accepting and tolerant town, a part of the reason JP and I chose to make it our home. According to the most recent census, the neighborhood boasted the 7th highest rate of same-sex couples in the nation and received top marks annually from the Human Rights Campaign. Situated between upscale Royal Heights to the north and modest Fern Ridge to the south, a mere 1,500 residents counted the Detroit suburb as their home. On the west side of Woodward Avenue, the main thoroughfare bisecting the community, spacious dwellings rested on oversized lots belonging to the upper middle class. The east side, affectionately dubbed Peasant Woods, gave way to smaller properties whose owners, while still well off, earned far smaller incomes. It was here that JP and I made our lives, after roughly 5 years together in Brooklyn. Back then, we never dreamed we'd ever own our own house. As an actor and a playwright, respectively, we resigned ourselves to being lifelong renters. Then one day, our luck changed. JP booked a supporting role on the highly rated TV cop show Brooklyn Beat as openly queer detective Sam Hardy. Meanwhile, my young adult mystery series, Murder High, featuring queer teen detective TJ Inkster, hit the New York Times bestseller list. Soon we stopped eating canned tuna and ramen for dinner. We saved up some money and moved to my native Michigan. Thanks to my best friend, Campbell Sellers, realtor extraordinaire, his descriptor, not mine, we purchased a 1924 Craftsman Colonial with a mortgage payment equaling $200 less than what we paid in Williamsburg, and with double the space. For the better part of the first year, we fixed up the 1,600-square-foot, four-bedroom home located at 1 Fairway Lane for all the world to see. As co-hosts of a hit home renovation show called Domestic Partners, we became household names, at least in the world of home design television, a.k.a. HDTV. What do they got good here? Finn scanned the QR code with his smartphone and pulled up the top dog menu. Everything's good. They've got a great arugula salad, comes with toasted walnuts, goat cheese, and sliced apples, JP answered. I chimed in. The burger's huge. I always end up taking half of it home for the boys. Finn's nostrils flared and he glanced up. Meat is murder, bro. We can't eat either of those. We're vegan. I knew that, I said, in reference to our dining companion's dietary restrictions. Because I did. I knew all about the ban, which Analog Ear called, quote, a refreshing departure from the polished and overproduced sound that dominates much of the mainstream music scene today, unquote. An Aquarius born in mid-February, Fiona Forrest grew up on a small farm in a small northern Michigan town outside of Traverse City. After being homeschooled, she attended the Motown Music Academy, where she met Finn Lowenstein, born on the Ides of March, making him a Pisces. The salad sounds yummy. We can always get it sans the goat cheese, said Fiona sweetly. At 19, F&F formed the aptly named Lo-Fi. Finn played keyboards, upright bass, and harmonica. Fiona sang, played acoustic guitar and ukulele, accompanied by her bow. They began their ascent to fame by posting songs and videos online. Before the Crazy Kids knew it, indie label Black Canvas signed them to an exclusive recording deal, launching the Lovebirds' music career. But it was Fiona's 25th birthday this past February 14th that would forever change both their worlds. After celebrating back in Brooklyn, where she and Finn also lived for a time, they returned home to Greenpoint for some post-dinner dessert. Her parents shipped the birthday girl a frozen Sanders bumpy cake, a delicacy rarely found outside Michigan, along with a case of Werner's Pop. Fiona called to thank her folks. The generous gifts reminded her of home, a place she hadn't visited since Lo-Fi's debut album Static Dreams scored them a Grammy nod as Best New Artist. On speaker, her mother and father told Fiona she should probably sit. The news they needed to share would surely come as a shock. Soon, the young woman learned the truth of a long-held family secret. As a twist of fate would have it, she was not Fiona Forrest, daughter of Greg and Gina, a humble farmer and his wife. Her given name at birth was Fiona Woods, as in William Royce Woods, the cursed lumber baron who died by his own hand after losing much of his fortune. Fiona's birth parents were none other than William Woods IV, a.k.a. Bill, and first wife Emma, the former Miss Great Lakes and Wheeler Automotive heiress, who on Halloween night 1997 fell from a third-floor balcony during her own birthday celebration. After her biological father's death 2 years later while on honeymoon with his new bride and former housekeeper, custody of two-year-old Fiona was granted to the girl's nanny and her groundskeeper husband. In his will, Bill Woods left the married couple enough money to comfortably raise his only child, far away from the tiny historic town of Pleasant Woods and the curse that had befallen his people for generations. A clause in their contract specified that neither Greg nor Gina would utter a word pertaining to Fiona's true identity. The girl was to be raised, and to live, as a Forrest until she reached her 25th year. On that St. Valentine's Day, all would be revealed. As the sole remaining heir to the Woods Lumber Dynasty, Fiona Forrest inherited the Woods family fortune, along with the stately arts and crafts-inspired manor known as Woods Hall. Her life would never be the same again. Chapter 3. A man and woman approached our semi-private booth.
Hey, sorry to interrupt.
Tall and rugged-looking, the guy appeared around my and JP's age. A thick beard covered his face, and he was blessed with an even thicker head of sandy hair. He wore a tight Detroit Hustle's Harder t-shirt, while a pair of well-ripped jeans hugged his meaty thighs. The woman, smaller in stature, was slightly younger in years, most likely mid-20s. Her curly red hair she wore in an updo. A vintage floral dress showed off a curvy figure. Her bright green eyes sparkled under the bar lights. Judging by the way she clung to the man's big arm, she seemed to be his girlfriend.
Told you it was them.
She didn't sound like the brightest bulb in the box, as my mother would say. But I made it a point to give people the benefit of the doubt before passing judgment.
We're a couple of lo-fi superfans, the guy confessed.
Fiona gently touched his arm with her hummingbird tattoo hand.
Aw, thank you so much. What brings you to the Motor City?
Asked the woman.
I'm Ashley, by the way. This is my boyfriend, Corey.
So I was right. They were BF and GF. Fiona greeted the couple kindly, as if they'd been besties forever.
Hey, Ashley and Corey. Finn and I live here now. Well, we're moving here. Soon as our new house is ready.
Corey did a double take, gaping at me and JP.
You're the domestic partner, dudes.
Aw, man, we watch your show all the time.
Thanks, we both said, pretty much in unison. Nice meeting you. JP addressed the man and woman as I sat back and kept silent. Even after two full seasons of beaming into the homes of 1.1 million HDTV viewers on a weekly basis, I couldn't get used to being recognized in public.
These brohams are fixing up our next place, said Finn, cutting into the conversation.
Corey ran a big hand through his thick hair.
Cool. Whereabouts?
He wasn't being nosy, I could tell. It was simply a Midwest kind of question. In Pleasant Woods, whenever you meet a fellow neighbor, the first thing they wanted to know was the street you lived on. 9 times out of 10, people would just rattle off their address. We live at 1 Fairway Lane, right off the alley, as if to say, feel free to come and stalk and or rob us.
When JP and I resided in New York City, we barely...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?